From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made 1 week from today in Paris. The 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference begins next Monday with a rather ambitious goal. The hope is for nothing short of a legally binding agreement from all the nations of the world on how to reduce the impact of climate change. You might recall that Pope Francis published his encyclical on climate called Laudato Si earlier this year, aimed at lending support for new action regarding climate. The moment is almost here, and the question in the air this week is anything going to happen? Will this conference actually get something done? Well, my guests for the hour are here from local organizations that are launching the Rochester March for Global Climate Action. They're going to lead an event this coming Sunday, and they've got a lot more to share about activism and the way they are taking a look at what's about to happen in Paris. In studio, let me welcome my guest. Sue Hughes-Smith is back. She is from both Mothers Out Front and the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Nice to have you here, Sue.
Nice to see you again, Evan.
Mary Lupien is also with Mothers Out Front, and she's the organizer of the upcoming Climate Action March. We'll talk about that in a moment. Mary, nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Tim McGowan's here, the founder and the group co-lead for Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester. Tim, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Good to be here.
On the phone with us is Sandra Steingraber, who's a distinguished scholar in residence in the Department of Environmental Studies for Ithaca College. Sandra, thank you for taking the time for this program.
You're welcome. Hi, everyone.
Sandra, let me start with you. I just asked everyone in this room before the program began, but you weren't here. I was asking, are you optimistic about what's about to happen in Paris? And there was this awkward silence for a moment, I have to say. Sandra, are you optimistic?
I am. I mean, we must succeed now. The scientific evidence shows us that we are, in fact, facing a climate emergency, and we're not talking anymore about potential future generations. We're talking about affecting the kids who sit across the dinner table from us every night. So as a parent, as a biologist, I'm going to Paris with a lot of urgency, and I'm also going to be wearing my science writer's hat. I'm reporting for EcoWatch. So the success or non-success of the negotiations will be recorded by me and lots of other journalists, and I'll be reporting daily on EcoWatch for people to follow.
And Sandra, when it comes to the expectations, or forget expectations, just the possibility for action, it is a nebulous thing to say that we want a new agreement that all the nations of the world will find legally binding regarding climate. But how much of an idea do you have about specifics that could be coming forth from Paris yet?
Well, we have to do two things at the same time. One is to close the door on fossil fuels. Thus, you see, and this is what I think you'll see, is a lot of the new kind of watchword is leave it in the ground. And so the sort of unholy trinity of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, simply have to become stranded assets. So the need to close the door on fossil fuels and declare the fossil fuel party over is one part of what will happen in Paris. The other half of it is to open another door, which is the door to renewable energy. So there is also, in addition to the negotiations going on among nation states, there is a kind of business fair of all kinds of sustainable industries that have new technologies to offer, batteries, solar panels, new ideas for wind and water power, that these will also be showcased there. So it's saying no to one 150-year-old project and saying yes to new innovation. It's the two halves of the climate.
And Sandra, let me just follow up with, I think, an important point here, which is that there are a number of people, and I'm sure a number listening right now, who still don't view what you would call clean energy, alternative energy, et cetera, as scalable enough to meet this moment. And I'll give you an example. A couple of weeks ago on this program, we talked with Suzanne Hunt from Hunt Green, and she and her family have helped lead this sort of charge towards solar energy in the Finger Lakes wine industry. We've gone from 1% solarized in the Finger Lakes wine industry to 10% in just a year, which is a pretty remarkable change. And on this program, Suzanne told me, she said, I would love it if nothing was subsidized, if no energy was subsidized, because people always say, well, solar needs subsidy, or homeowners need subsidy to put solar panels on. Why all the subsidy? And she says, do you know how much we subsidize fossil fuels? I would love it if we took all subsidies out, let it be an even playing field, but we're not going there. And right now, the field is sort of loaded against it. Well, we actually had a listener write in to say, yeah, but But fossil fuel is profitable. We know that. And the others are not. And that's what we hear. So, Sandra, I'm curious to know what you make of that.
Well, I'll speak as a biologist and a person who studies the public health impacts of fossil fuels. There are a lot of externalities to the economics of fossil fuels that don't get counted in statements like that. Coal alone kills millions of people a year because of air pollution, right? So we're not just, when we burn fossil fuels and we create ovens to light them on fire to turn on our lights, we're not just loading up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, but also we are loading up the atmosphere with combustion byproducts that make people sick. And the kinds of sicknesses that they create and contribute to are very expensive. We're talking about things like stroke and heart attack risks, cancers, preterm birth, and so forth. And so there are millions of dollars of healthcare dollars that are spent on that. And so we solve two problems at once when we get off of fossil fuels. We create atmospheric stability, which allows agriculture and pollination and plankton and all the ecosystem services that are at the foundation of our economy to flourish. But at the same time, we're saving healthcare dollars from the toxic exposures that we get by breathing in all the combustion byproducts. All of those things, and this is not just me kind of speculating. There are actual peer-reviewed written papers in the scientific and economic literature making the case that fossil fuels have many external costs, and renewable energy just makes sense, not only from a public health and climate point of view, but also from an economic point of view. So I think the data are firmly on our side here.
But one quick follow-up, Sandra, and then I'm going to kind of go around the table, and we're going to talk about what everyone is getting ready for as we're a week away from the UN climate talks. How scalable, are some of these forms of energy? I ask because our listeners ask that question every time we either talk solar, wind, whatever, algae, whatever it is. People say, okay, but is it scalable?
It's scalable. This is doable. This is what my engineer friends tell me. And I think there's this kind of peculiar pessimism that surrounds energy that doesn't surround, for example, telecommunications. You know, no one is saying anymore, oh, let's cling to the rotary dial phone because it's reliable. It's what we've done since 1937. We're all walking around with the equivalent of entire libraries in our pockets and GPS systems in our iPhones, precisely because people were early adapters, right? We believed in that kind of innovation, and we moved forward so that my kids talk to their friends in ways that I don't even understand. And my mother doesn't know how to use my phone, but she can look out her window and see the same coal-burning power plant that's been burning there ever since I was born, and I'm 56 years old. So why is it that our energy system are literally and figuratively fossilized and refuse to evolve, whereas telecommunications is leaping forward, and we're all expected to somehow learn this and catch up with it, whether or not it's reliable or not, there's always something new coming out. So it's that same spirit of innovation that we need to bring to energy that we've already done for telecommunications. The problem, of course, is that the fossil fuel industry is holding hostage all of these renewable energies. And so essentially, the Paris negotiations are a form of hostage rescue operations to bring water, wind, and solar power, liberate them, deploy them, and we'll learn to scale the more we deploy. The answer is just to deploy.
All right. Before we pivot to our friends in studio here, let me grab a phone call. And this is Robert in Aranaqui. He wants to weigh in on a specific point he's been hearing. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, my only issue here is I am not going to point the finger at global warming or climate change right away at fossil fuels until we address why there's chemtrails in the eastern sky from the jets every other day, why the HAARP project in Alaska is bombarding the upper atmosphere with radio waves and electricity to bend weather patterns, if you will. I don't have a problem with renewable energies as long as the energy companies can sell them to you. They're just perfect. I could have a windmill in my backyard, and the town of Rondeau is going to tell you to take it down. Why? Because now I can get my renewable energy free. Can't do that. You've got to buy it from a big company. So renewable energies are great as long as somebody can sell it to you. And the other thing, too, my answer to get this country's energy crisis turned around is every broken downtown across America can grow commercial hemp in squeezy oils. You can't tell me that RIT can't figure out how to burn that and get 40 miles a gallon on hemp. Talk amongst yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Tim, you want to weigh in there? Go ahead,
sure,
Tim.
A couple things. First of all, on what Susan was talking about and also what this gentleman calling in was referring to. On the issue of subsidies, the real piece that we need to look at is to put that in context. What's going to help the economy nationally and globally transition from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy? Fundamentally, that's going to be the market, and it's going to be putting a price on carbon. So I'm not sure where that process of pricing carbon is on the agenda of Paris at this point, but it is the fundamental issue. So that the more that the more expensive that that fossil fuel products become, that's going to drive investment into renewables. It's going to drive greater efficiencies both on the corporate and on the homestead level. So what we really need to look at is pricing carbon. And we have a proposal with Citizen Climate Lobby that does that on the national legislative level.
What's the brief model for how it works, Tim?
The brief model is this. It imposes a steadily rising tax on fossil fuel products at their source point. And it establishes, to begin with, a $15 a ton CO2 equivalent tax that increases by $10 each year over the course of 10 years. The result of that is that by the year 2030, we could be looking at a reduction of 90% CO2 levels below the 1990 levels. And we could also be looking at a net job growth increase of 2.8 million jobs. So the key thing is internalizing, as Sandra mentioned, is internalizing the costs of carbon, of CO2 emissions. And that's what our proposal seeks to do.
I don't know about hemp oil. I mean, it's an interesting idea from Robert there. But Sandra Steingraber, he talked about flight. He talked about vapor trails in the sky. He talked about other things, saying he didn't want to point the finger directly at fossil fuels. Do you want to weigh in on that, Sandra?
Well, I'm talking about data. So I'm focused on two greenhouse gases. They come in two flavors, methane and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide and methane are both products of fossil fuel combustion and extraction. Carbon dioxide lasts longer. It lasts about 100 years in the atmosphere. Methane lasts only about a dozen years, but it's 86 times more potent a greenhouse gas. So what that means is that all three greenhouse gases, coal, oil, and natural gas, need to be phased out as soon as possible. This is what the science shows us. We are now approaching the point where so-called ecological tipping points will occur, triggering runaway climate change that no matter what we do after that point, we can't rein this in. And so we have only about a dozen years or so left to us to solve this problem. So getting off of fossil fuels is an urgent issue. There are many urgent issues, but this one now occupies center stage. And all of us who have children, all of us who believe in the abidingness of life, have to take all this science on board now and put one foot in front of the other and take action, that we're all obligated to do this, and we just need to stay focused on that task.
We're a week away from Paris, and our panel is talking about the UN climate talks in Paris that are coming up here. And I want to turn to some of our other guests in studio about not only what's coming up here, but also sort of activism that we're seeing around the world reflected here in the Finger Lakes, in Rochester. Sue Hugh-Smith, you wanted to weigh in as well on what you just heard?
Yeah, and just on the idea of you know, the need to know exactly the endpoint and exactly the path. You know, I think we've all probably driven on a foggy evening and you don't really see very far ahead of you, right? But you have lights and you just keep going and you keep going and you keep going and eventually you get where you need to be. And I think that's the mindset that we need to take with climate change, is that very same mindset. We just need to get started. And whether it's for yourself personally, whether it's working with others in your community, whether it's getting involved with some of these international organizations, we got to start. And once you start, more people are going to start, and eventually we're going to get where we need to be. And that's going to come in a lot of different forms.
Listeners, I know you've got questions on how to get started and sort of reflecting on what Sue's talking about. We're going to be getting to some of the questions I've seen already. I've had a couple of emails, people asking, are we talking about ending actual fossil fuels, like done forever? And the question is when? We're going to get to that in a minute. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Exactly what Sue is talking about, I think, is reflected in people like Mary Lupien, who is with Mothers Out Front and the organizer of the upcoming Climate Action March. Now, first of all, Mary, the Climate Action March that's coming up Sunday in Rochester, what are the details?
Sure. It's Sunday, the Sunday after Thanksgiving, 1 o'clock. It starts and ends at St. Luke's Episcopal Church on Fitzhugh. We will be having some speakers. The bishop of the Episcopal Diocese will be speaking. We've put an ask out to Lovely Warren, and we're hoping to receive an answer this week on that. And after the speakers have made their case that we need to act right now, we will be marching around policy and climate important spots, and then coming back, and we'll have kind of a wrap-up celebration with the Dady Brothers and kids' activities.
Okay, so starts at 1 until about when?
I'd say probably it would be over by 2:30.
Okay, so about 90 minutes.
Family friendly.
Yeah, and Mary, you're someone who, you know, I know you were eager to kind of talk about your own personal story, because when Sue says we have to get started, and getting started is hard when you can't see the end point, and some people that just feels paralyzing. You're someone who, here you are now, you're talking about organizing this kind of event. You're with Mothers Out Front. What's your story? Why did you get involved?
Well, you know, I've been interested in the climate for a while, ever since I saw The Inconvenient Truth, you know, way back when. But it didn't really affect my life until maybe in the past 5 years, when I started noticing how many more climate events we were having. And it started to feel like a snowball. And I did feel overwhelmed, and I didn't know what to do. And to be honest, I buried it, like a lot of people do, I think. Just getting through life, you can't really think about it, because then you'll have to do something if you really admit what an urgent crisis it is. It wasn't until I had my daughter that things really started to get real for me. And I started to think about, gosh, what is her world going to look like when she's an adult, and it's, you know, it's not going to look anything like my world. And I, to be honest, I have a lot of anxiety around the climate. So much so that sometimes, you know, after we've had a big climate event, like, the category 6 hurricane that we had, Patricia, that was off the charts. And, you know, I'll lay awake at night feeling this anxiety, and it kind of transforms itself into this irrational fear where I have to go check on my kids to make sure they're okay. And I feel like it's something that's I can control, because I don't feel like I can control just me, this climate. It's so big, this climate issue. But what I found is the only thing that helps me to take that anxiety away is action. And the groups that I found in Rochester to work with, Mothers Out Front, which is a group for women and mothers, and Rochester People's Climate Coalition, which really brings all of the organizations together in Rochester, I can do something. And that makes me feel incredibly powerful. And I wish that everyone knew how powerful they were if they just stood up.
All right, let me go ahead, Tim.
I just wanted to add to that in terms of what both Sue and Mary are saying, and that is, and you began with this question: What about Paris? The fact that Paris is happening is a sign of hope. The fact that the global community, with all the diversity in the world, literally, is acknowledging that there is something happening to this planet, and we need to respond. We need to take responsibility. Is fundamental. The fact that in Rochester, I think, is unusual throughout the country, but that we have 35 members organizations that are part of the People's Climate Coalition. The fact that last year there were 400,000 people that gathered in New York City. This is a movement, and this is a process that is on the species level, and it's on the deeply and intimately personal level, as Mary was just saying. So that, to me, is the hope, is the energy. as Sue was saying before, something is going to, we need to do something. We cannot not respond in some initial way. And so as we look at Paris, as we look at our own local activities, it's there's something about the human and the human condition that is a source of hope, that is about creativity, it's about adaptation, and it's about putting that to use for the common good.
We're going to talk in 3 weeks and see if you agree with that sentiment.
That's a deal.
Let me get back to the phones, and Danielle in Irondequoit wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Danielle.
Hi. I want to thank you for taking the call. One thing that keeps coming in my head over and over again when I hear people talk about is the scalable. I feel like the thought process is that we have to choose one thing for the entire globe. And I think that is where the issue was in the first place. Coal is fine. Gasoline is fine. All of these terrible things, they're fine for a few people to do, not for every single person on the planet. If we could find one thing that works for everyone on the planet, that would be great until there was a problem with that one thing. If we have, 20 or 30 or 50 ideas that work, none of them have to be huge. They can work a small amount for these people and these people. And if it starts to break down, there's 20 other things that pick up the slack. So that's my thought on it. I'll listen to you guys off the air. Thank you very much for having this conversation.
Danielle, thanks for the phone call. Sandra Steingraber from Ithaca College, you want to weigh in first? Go ahead.
Sure. So the data are exactly supportive of what our caller just said. So there's a Stanford engineer and some of our finest Cornell professors who are involved in something called the Solutions Project, which you can simply Google, called Solutions Project. And what it is a blueprint for every single state in the union for how that state, including New York State, could entirely get off of fossil fuels and embrace renewable energy by a certain time, how many jobs would be created, how many lives would be saved, how it would be capitalized. And as you can imagine, the blueprint for a state like Maine and the mix of renewables, specific kinds of mix, is different than what would be happening in Arizona. So that's right. All of the renewable energy portfolio is going to be ecologically sensible for wherever we happen to be. And for New York State, it would involve a lot of offshore wind. And we've just been given a huge boost toward that goal by Governor Cuomo, who just vetoed a fossil fuel project, the Port Ambrose LNG terminal, which would have occupied the same space in New York Harbor that would be most suited for wind power. So in this case, a fossil fuel proposed project actually competes directly with a renewable project. And to his abiding credit, the governor decided to close the door on the old ideas of the past. And hopefully, again, it's all about closing one door and opening another, created the possibility for something else. And while I have a moment here, I do want to say that here in the Finger Lakes, we're also holding a march at the same time in the same place that the good folks in Rochester are. Don't want to compete with that, but for any listener who's a little bit closer to Watkins Glen and Seneca Lake, we are Seneca Lake, which is a group that I work with, is hosting a march down here. It's the March in the Finger Lakes, and it's one of thousands of marches that are happening all around the world on Sunday, November 29th. The largest one was to have been in Paris, but that one, because of the state of emergency, has been canceled by the police, and so we're all being asked now to march on behalf of the Parisians as well as on behalf of all the people of the world. So our family-friendly march is also beginning at 1 along the south shore of Seneca Lake at the Watkins Glen Marina. We're going to actually march down to the Watkins Glen State Park, which is about a mile and a half, and then back again, and we'll also have some speakers. We're all wearing orange to show that this is an emergency, and also because in response to a wisecrack that one of our local officials made when we announced our march on Facebook, he posted underneath our photo, remember deer season starts on Saturday, which is really kind of shocking. So in response, we're wearing orange to show that we're not a herd of deer and that we will not be intimidated. And that our message that we bring love and determination, not fear, and that this is a movement that's unstoppable, will make it clear who we are and what our message is as we march with our families.
Just a quick comment from a listener named Chuck on Twitter. He says, Evan, please ask the panel about the number one climate problem, and it's not fossil fuels. He says, it's animals. Methane is greater and worse than carbon. It's bad for our water. And that's from Chuck. And Sandra, I've heard people urging us to see Cowspiracy, things like that, saying carbon sure is an issue, but it's not nearly the problem that the animal industry is.
Okay, well, let me lay that out then. So there are anthropogenic sources of methane, and then there are natural sources of methane, such as swamps. And just as there are natural sources of carbon dioxide, each of us inhale a pint of atmosphere with every breath. We exhale CO2. But in the methane cycle, we are driving it farther and faster with natural gas extraction, distribution, and storage than any other source. That's now the number one source of methane. It exceeds animal agriculture, which is not to say that our forms of our agriculture are not also problematic, but we are at a moment in history now where what is driving methane into the atmosphere, which again is 86 times more powerful than CO2 as a heat-trapping gas, the number one source is natural gas extraction and exploitation. So that's why we have to focus on that piece of it. There are all kinds of things to do with our agricultural system, too. These, of course, aren't mutually exclusive. We're all used to doing more than one thing at one time. So all the sources of greenhouse gas emissions need to be looked at. But you need to strike at the ones that are huge.
Paul on Twitter says it's remarkably fitting that Rochester and down near Seneca Lake would host another example of women taking a lead in historic import. That's from Paul on Twitter. And Tim is pumping his fist in solidarity there, Paul. So, all right, we're late for a break, and here's what we're going to do. If you're waiting on the phone, we're going to get to you in our second half hour. It's going to go quickly. We've got a lot to talk about. Our listeners have wanted to know about specifics, about if we're serious about getting past fossil fuels, when? I mean, when are we going to wake up in a world where there are not gas stations and things like that? And is it ridiculous to think about that, or is it absolutely important, and are we on the eve of that? As Paris is coming up, the UN climate talks start 1 week from today in Paris, and our panel is helping set up for not only what's happening there, but as you heard Sandra Steingraber say, what's happening here. The Paris marches have been essentially kind of quelled because of security threats, and so now people will be marching around the world. Rochester has one. Seneca Lake, Watkins Glen, they've got one. Sandra Steingraber is a distinguished scholar in residence in the Department of Environmental Studies from Ithaca College. And in studio with us, Sue Hughes-Smith from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, Mary Lupien, the organizer of the Climate Action March here, Tim McGowan, the founder and the group co-lead for Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester. Short break, your phone calls, and we're going to get specific next. Coming up in our second hour, it's a social media roundtable, both from a legal and ethical perspective. We're talking about a number of stories in recent news, not the least of which is Yik Yak, University of Rochester students demanding that the university end Yik Yak on campus for racist reasons. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about social media in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. All of that and more next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to get to the phones, and Michael in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, Evan. Hi there. The issue of scalability is done. Apple's putting in an $800 million solar plant in California. That's scale right there. And ironically, talking about scale, there's a gas leak in California, Aliso Canyon, that's releasing a quarter of California, the entire state of California's methane right now is from a gas leak that they cannot stop. It may take months for them to stop it. It's been already a month. And it's similar to BP, except we just can't see the gas like we could the oil. That's scale of disaster, and that's what solar and most other renewables don't have. So We have scale. It's here. Thank you.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for the phone call. Tim McGowan?
Yeah, just a quick fact on that leakage natural gas. It's only a 3.5% leakage of natural gas that becomes equivalent to the CO2 content of coal. So leakage is a major issue with natural gas, and it's that minimal amount or percentage is equivalent to the CO2 of coal.
Sandra, you want to weigh in as well?
We're following that story from California very closely, because the leak is actually originating from an underground natural gas storage unit. And, of course, here in Seneca Lake, we've been fighting an underground storage unit of our own. So the fact that, and I think the comparison to BP is a good one, the fact that we can create leaks in these underground geological formations that were never intended or engineered to hold a fossil fuel, and then they become unfixable. We can't reach them. You know, these things are vapors. So that makes it very tough. It's like finding a leak in a balloon where helium is leaking, but 1,000 feet under the earth, where you can't actually send a human down there to do it. And so when you have these kind of fossil fuel infrastructure projects that hold the possibility of unfixable climate catastrophe, it's a price too high.
Sue Hughes-Smith from the Rochester People Climate Coalition.
Yeah, I just read a book recently from Earth Policy Institute called The Great Transition. Lester Brown, he's been writing on these issues for a long time. And he says it's here. You know, this is the change that's occurring is faster than ever before, that there are on a number of parameters, like the number of gas stations has actually declined in the United States, and that's attributed to more fuel-efficient cars and more people choosing those fuel-efficient cars. So I think if we get, you know, some of the price structures correct, like a carbon tax, something that causes fossil fuels to account for its very destructive nature instead of being a free ride, we will see the transition happen much, much faster than anyone is predicting. To me, that is the point. Probably the greatest hope that I have on this issue is that it's here. And when I work with all kinds of people here in Rochester and other parts of New York State, coming forward and saying it's enough, we're going to have this change. It's going to come.
Mary?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that there's something that you can do, anyone can do right now in their own homes to switch their own homes over to clean electricity. The group that I'm part of, Mothers Out Front, has partnered with a company called Ethical Electric. And all you have to do is go to mothersoutfront.com, and within a couple of clicks, you've switched your house over to clean electricity. And it's not like you have a direct line from the sun, but what you're doing is you're offsetting the coal and the dirty energy that you would have bought from your energy supplier, and you're replacing it with clean and renewable energy, and you're investing that money into the building of the infrastructure of renewable energy. And the average is about $20 mm-hmm. extra a month.
All right, I want to get to another couple of questions listeners have had, and John in Rochester, I think, is going to help us take a look at the timetable. John thinks we're moving too quickly. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. You know, I'm a proponent of solar and wind energy. I love the concept, et cetera. I just think we're moving too quickly. I don't know what the percentage is of producing energy in the energy grid, what the percentage they contribute right now. It's pretty small, my understanding is. But my theory is this. I think we need to slow this down and take advantage of the natural resources we have with gas, coal, et cetera, and really use that as an economic generator for the United States to get out of this hole and create some real economic vitality and move slower into solar and wind.
I'm really glad John is interested in economic growth, and I think we need to be clear that renewables generates many more jobs and will create much more economic growth than fossil fuels. There are lots of independent research that's demonstrating that. And a lot of that growth comes to reducing healthcare costs and other negative impacts from the fossil fuels that John's advocating.
The problem with that, is if we have a demand, let's say industry needs a certain amount of energy, and that part of the grid, as far as production goes from solar and wind, cannot give that energy in enough time, that's going to slow down the industrial production in this country and put us at a disadvantage. I think we should move slower and use those resources as much as possible to maximize our profit, etc. The other issue, too, I think this movement has gotten caught up with anti-capitalist movements. Some leftist organization for many, many years have been anti-capitalist and pushing Marxism, etc. And I think that has influenced the environmental movement in a deficient way. I'll give you an example. Naomi Klein is a anti-capitalist Marxist. She now is jumped on the bandwagon of climate change because she feels that this is a way to slow down capitalism and negate capitalism. In fact, I think the Pope has actually hired her as a consultant on climate change. So I think there's some dangers here of this movement being tainted by the anti-capitalism and Marxist philosophies and economics. And I think, I don't know if you guys are aware of that. I don't think you're involved with the Marxist movement, but I think there's a lot of degrowthers out there that are looking to use this as a tool to decrease the United States industrial power in this world. And
all right, John, I appreciate the phone call. I got to let the panel, they all want to respond. I'm going to go around the table and start with Mary Lupien from Mothers Out Front and the organizer of the upcoming Climate Action March. Mary, go ahead.
Sure. I do recognize that that there are a lot of people that are environmentalists and also anti-capitalists. And I do see that there are some relationships between the climate issue and how we've burned fossil fuels so in a way that's out of control. And just like to mention, you know, companies like ExxonMobil, it was recently announced that they've known about climate change since 1970, but put a lot of effort into suppressing that message in pursuit of profits. And I'm not saying that that's the capitalist model, but certainly capitalism lends itself to that kind of behavior. And I think that's where you're seeing a lot of people coming out against capitalism.
And Sue Hughes-Smith, for example, when John says, you know, they're concerned about anti-capitalism, okay, I mean, he's not the only one concerned about that, but every time I've talked to you and Tim and Sandra and James Hansen, who is on this program that Tim helped bring in, what I hear is we need to appeal to the free market, to innovation, and to looking at the economic impacts, not saying if we wreck the economy, we wreck the economy. I'm actually hearing the opposite, but
right.
Go ahead, Sue.
Exactly. I mean, studies show that if we do nothing and just continue business as usual, the cost of dealing with the increasing messes from climate change will increase about 8% of our GDP. Okay, the cost of actually moving to a renewable energy system that will make people healthier and create jobs and doesn't give anyone a free ride, like the fossil fuel companies a free ride anymore, will only cost something around 3 to 4% of GDP. So it makes much more sense to use the market as a tool to solve this problem. And right now, that's the whole irony for me, is the fossil fuel companies, they're not playing by a free market economy. They're getting special, you know, compensation. They're getting subsidies. They're not paying their true cost to society. So let's use the market. Let's allow the market to do what it's supposed to do.
Okay. Tim McGowan.
Yeah, no, precisely so. I just want to talk with John briefly about, I really agree with you, John, about economic growth and the importance of economic growth. And simply this, that the scalable issue of renewables will be resolved by the market through its own internal energy. So once fossil fuels become more expensive, there is going to be an enormous investment of capital in research and development in technology for renewables. We haven't seen anything yet in terms of what's going to be happening when capital, when the free market moves towards this newer, ancient form of energy.
Okay, Sandra Steingraber?
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up in the coal country of Illinois, and from my point of view, if you seek economic vitality, you don't look for communities that live on top of oil, gas, or coal, because what you'll find is poverty and social blight. That's true in Appalachia. That's true in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's true where I grew up in Mother Jones territory of downstate Illinois. Here where I live now, in the Finger Lakes, which is a kind of engine of sustainable ideas, we have an army of white trucks coming through my village. 10 years ago, those white trucks would have represented Chesapeake Energy, but thanks to the ban on fracking, we've opened the door to renewables. And so what those white trucks say on their side is Renovus, which is a solar energy company. Renovus has provided 100 new jobs just this year and last, to local folks that are good full-time jobs, as compared to the 8 to 10 full-time jobs that Houston-based Crestwood is promising by opening up crumbly old salt caverns on the west shore of Seneca Lake to serve as a massive gas station for frack gas. So the economic vitality is firmly on the side of renewables, and the biological imperative to get off of fossil fuels, the data is firmly on that side. So as far as I can see, the scientific data and the economic data are all aligned, and they're all pointing us toward a renewable future.
All right, Sandra, I got to jump in here and say to our listeners, if you're waiting on the phones, every phone line's lit up. We're going to try to get through as much as we can in the last 10 minutes, so we're going to try to keep it moving. But Sandra, on John's point where he said we're moving too quickly, what are the options for actually, as you said earlier, leaving fossil fuels in the ground and creating a world essentially where we're not burning them anymore? But when? What's the earliest realistic timetable where we are not using fossil fuels at all?
Mid-century. 2050. We can do that. That's doable. That's what's on the table for discussion in Paris. And ironically, the person who convinced me of this is actually a guy who's a venture capitalist named Jeremy Grantham, who oddly enough wrote a commentary a few years ago in a journal that all biologists read called Nature. And what Jeremy Grantham said is that, look, I predict the futures market, and I can't do it anymore because fossil fuels are wrecking the wheat harvests and messing up commodities prices and basically creating an existential threat to not only to the economy but to people themselves. And so scientists really need to be more loud about the urgency of this crisis. And so I was really led into my activism as a biologist on climate change by a capitalist.
Okay. Real briefly, Tim, go ahead.
Sure. Just to the point of businesses' involvement in the UN climate talks. There are coalitions of businesses globally that have come out to say that they are interested in the most aggressive, the most effective possible outcome of Paris possible. They know what's happening. They see what's at stake. They see what's at stake for whatever it is, the pension funds, insurance, whatever it is. And so actually the business community nationally, 81 corporations gathered together by President Obama, and globally, I don't know how many, I know of at least 150, are in the vanguard of saying, wow, people, we need to wake up. We need to do something rapidly in terms of putting a price on carbon and getting this under control. So the business community is a real hopeful energy.
All right, but Tim, one of our listeners, a different Tim in Pittsburgh, says carbon tax, say those words to lawmakers, and you see how quickly you realize how that wish goes away with the Republican majority. Tim in Pittsburgh is saying that is not happening. Whatever Paris wants to do, our leadership in this country is not signing up for it. Tim McGowan?
It's a complex picture. While that might seem to be the case on the surface, Representative Chris Gibson around the Albany area last month introduced a resolution that at this point, 10 anyway, House Republicans have signed on to, saying this is climate change, this is real, and we have a responsibility to do something about it as a national legislature. Secondly, about 2 weeks ago in the Senate, Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, along with three other senators, came out with a working group on energy and the environment with the purpose of saying in the Senate among Republicans, hey, we need to do something. So things are beginning, despite the media of Fox News and Trump, et cetera, on climate change, there is something taking place on a deeper level within the Republican Party moving in this direction.
All right, we'll see if he's right. Susan Spencer is the CEO of Rockspot, and she's on the phone with us. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, Evan. Hi, panel. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to respond to John's assumptions about the pace at which we should be deploying renewable energy and how the business community views this. So he brought up anti-capitalism. You know, Walmart, which is very much a capitalist company, uses more solar power than 38 states. Warren Buffett, I think we all know who Warren Buffett is, he owns utilities, and his utility in Nevada is now producing solar power cheaper than it is to produce natural gas. So they're making electricity from solar at a rate cheaper than natural gas, which puts it at something called grid parity. So right now, in 2016, we're going to be at a point here in the United States where every state but three will be at grid parity with solar power. This means that if you put the technology up, it's going to be the same price or cheaper than using coal-based or fossil fuel-based electricity from the grid. So it really is, there's a big mythology that this technology is not ready, that we should slow down, we can't deploy it and maintain our economy. And all of the data over the last 10 years and the data it's pushing out into the future shows that that's demonstrably false.
But Susan, I'm hoping you can join our program coming up here in just a few weeks, and we're going to talk more about grid parity, but also the question on how utilities are dealing with it. Is grid parity at risk if the RG&Es of the world assess a fee, essentially trying to kind of push back a little into the market?
Sure, of course it is. I mean, we look at Arizona, and they have a fee because you're not burning enough coal anymore, right? But those fees, and especially here in New York State, we already pay to be on the grid. So the argument that any solar user or wind user, for that matter, needs to pay more is a facetious claim.
Susan, thanks for the phone call. She's the CEO of Rockspot, and we're going to talk to her on an upcoming program about these issues and many more. I just want to get through as many phone calls as we can because we're loaded up. Andy in Rochester, go ahead.
Hi, great show today, and I want to thank your guests for what they do. John brought up an important topic, and that is about, you know, attacking capitalism, which I think certain people equate that with attacking patriotism, and they have a heart. It's almost unpatriotic not to burn fossil fuels anymore or to eat animals anymore. And I'll just say this. I know that Fort Drum up near Watertown, the Army base, is becoming very solar. There's solar all over that place, so I don't think you could be any more patriotic than that. And then I just want to add one more thing. I would encourage people to watch the documentary Cowspiracy. Mm-hmm. And I think the number one thing that people individually can do is to stop eating animals and go vegan. And thanks for the show today. Thanks.
Andy, thank you. I will just say, I know Sandra Steingraber replied to some of the earlier similar comments on that. So let me grab one more phone call. And Jane is next up. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes. I don't think John needs to worry about very much because we have a corporate-owned government. What I miss in this conversation, and it may have been covered, and in some ways it seems like it is, Howard Zinn used to say that the largest problems we've ever had were usually solved by a grassroots populace, an active citizenry, as opposed to depending on the government or corporations, God forbid, to lead us to good solutions. And I'm on dissing corporations because of the recent Volkswagen fraud and so forth, because you have to watch them every minute. But whether it's war and peace or expanding democracy, it's not until we take the responsibility and move forward. And just one simple example, I know more people right now who do not recycle than I know who recycle. And so we have power that we do not use. Can you talk a little bit about Howard Zinn's approach, what it might have been to this?
Well, Jane, thank you. We're almost out of time. Sue, go ahead quickly.
Yeah, I just want to thank the last two callers tremendously for your insight and say, if you're ready to act, please join us. Come down to the march on Sunday. Look at the Rochester People's Climate Coalition website. We've got 12 days of action so that every day we can think about what we personally can do, how that intersects with our global environment.
When do your 12 days of action start?
So they start on Monday the 30th.
To coincide with
Paris
and the UN climate?
Exactly.
And Mary, briefly, the march on Sunday is where?
It's at St. Luke's Episcopal Church on Fitzhugh at 1 o'clock. And we'll be marching around downtown.
And as Sue said, family-friendly. Tim McGowan, mm-hmm. some brief final comments. Go ahead.
If you're interested in carbon legislation in the House and in the Senate, CitizensClimateLobby.org is where you can go to learn about our proposal.
CitizensClimateLobby.org there. And Sandra, down on Seneca Lake.
Down on Seneca Lake at 1 o'clock on Sunday, we're marching in orange. And so go to WeAreSenecaLake.com for more details, and then follow my reportage from the climate negotiations in Paris. I'll be there December 3rd through December 13th.
Where are you on Twitter so we can follow you there, Sandra?
I'm on @SteingraeberOne.
Thank you for taking the time, Sandra. We'll talk to you after Paris.
Thanks, Evan.
And so much thanks goes to our panel in studio, Tim McGowan with Citizens Climate Lobby. Thank you, Tim.
Very welcome.
Mary Lupi, an organizer of the upcoming Climate March. Thank you, Mary. Sue Hugh Smith from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, more connections next.